Memory is not a vault we deposit things into. It is a living economy of signals, constraints, and transformations. What we call a memory begins as a fragile pattern in the present, held in a narrow workspace of attention. Then, if conditions are right, it is written into longer-lasting traces that can later be reinstated and revised. This pathway is shaped by two facts that sit in tension. The first is scarcity. The mind's workbench is sharply limited, easily saturated, and exquisitely sensitive to how information arrives. The second is plasticity. Given time and the right biological backdrop, the brain can stabilize, reorganize, and even distill experience into more general knowledge. Between scarcity and plasticity lies the story of how perception hardens into the past. The route from momentary awareness to durable memory runs through several distinct but overlapping systems. Working memory is the bottleneck where attention binds sights, sounds, and ideas into a coherent object for thought. Short-term buffers can keep such objects warm for a brief interval without much manipulation. And long-term stores, distributed across cortex but indexed rapidly by the hippocampus, support both episodic recollection and semantic knowledge. These systems are not merely logical categories, they have recognizable biological signatures. Synapses potentiate and depress. Dendritic spines wax and wane. Networks synchronize and then settle into quieter stability. Some of this reshaping is subtractive. As I argued in our earlier discussion of synaptic pruning, the nervous system improves not only by adding connections, but by sculpting away the noisy and redundant, leaving cleaner pathways for signal to travel. Some of it is rhythmic. In our recent exploration of sleep's architecture, we saw how slow wave and REM stages form a nightly choreography in which hippocampal replay, thalamic spindles, and cortical slow oscillations coordinate the stabilization and integration of the day's traces. Because almost everything must pass through the bottleneck of the present, the mechanics of input matter. John Sweller's cognitive load theory begins here. If working memory is narrow, then the way information is structured determines whether it can be bound, encoded, and ultimately consolidated. Intrinsic complexity, avoidable distractions, and the constructive effort of building schemas compete for the same scarce workspace. Tip that balance the wrong way, and learning collapses into fragments. In earlier work, I proposed extending this logic into a dynamic model, treating load as something we can measure and modulate rather than merely lament. The biological claim beneath the pedagogy is simple. If you overwhelm the gate, the hippocampus receives a noisy, poorly bound pattern. If you match structure to capacity, you give consolidation something worth saving. What follows takes this pathway in order. We begin with working memory, the machinery of the present, then consider cognitive load as the principle that governs what gets through. We turn next to short-term buffers and their vulnerabilities, then to the cellular and systems biology of long-term storage, synaptic and systems consolidation, pruning, replay, and the nocturnal chemistry that makes stabilization possible. We close by distinguishing two destinations within long-term memory, episodic and semantic, showing how the brain keeps them apart, why they persist and fail differently, and how over time vivid particulars are often distilled into general knowledge while those same generalities shape what becomes vivid in the first place. Working memory. Working memory is the mind's workspace, a dynamic, capacity-limited system that sustains and manipulates representations long enough for thought to occur. It is not a passive shelf on which items rest, but an active field in which attention, perception, and intention are bound into a single, temporarily coherent scene. Classical models parse this workspace into partially separable resources for verbal, auditory, and visuospatial content, coordinated by a supervisory central executive, with an episodic buffer proposed to explain how fragments from different modalities are knitted into a unitary, currently accessible representation. Whatever the taxonomy, two features define the phenomenon. First, the system is sharply bounded. Only a few meaningful structures can be stabilized at once, which forces a competition for representational real estate. Second, the system is costly. Sustained maintenance requires continuous neural work, and the longer an item must be held and transformed, the more susceptible it becomes to interference. The biology of this workspace makes the constraints intelligible. Prefrontal circuits, interacting with posterior sensory areas, sustain activity patterns that encode the contents of the moment. Striatal and thalamocortical loops regulate the gating of these patterns, determining when to admit new information and when to protect what is already active. Dopamine, among other neuromodulators, tunes the stability-flexibility trade-off. Too much openness and representations are washed away by incoming noise, too much protection, and the system perseverates, failing to update when the world changes. At finer scales, oscillatory coordination appears to provide the temporal infrastructure for maintenance and binding, slower rhythms setting the phase for bursts of faster activity that carry item-specific information, so that disparate neural populations can be synchronized into a single cognitive act. In this picture, capacity is not a set number of slots, but a function of how many distinct, interference-resistant patterns can be kept phase-organized and sufficiently separated in representational space. Because working memory is both limited and metabolically dear, its contents are exquisitely sensitive to how input is structured. An utterance that aligns with the grain of existing representations imposes a lighter burden than an equivalent flood of unsegmented detail. A diagram whose parts naturally group into higher-order units occupies less of the workspace than the same information scattered across modalities and screens. The episodic buffer is crucial here. Without a mechanism for momentary binding, the system would devolve into parallel tracks that never cohere. With it, the mind can momentarily assemble a multimodal now, a sentence heard, a figure seen, a goal held in mind, and pass a bound pattern forward for encoding. Working memory thus serves as the gatekeeper to memory proper. If the present cannot be held long enough, or if its elements cannot be bound into a single addressable pattern, the hippocampus has nothing coherent to index and later reinstate. If, on the other hand, the system stabilizes a well-structured representation, organized, meaningful, and minimally contaminated by noise, then downstream mechanisms have a target worth saving. This is why, in our broader account of memory formation, the physics of the present moment matters so much. The architecture of the workspace determines the quality of what the past can become. Cognitive load theory. Cognitive load theory begins with the simple but powerful premise that learning is constrained by the narrow channel of working memory. If the workspace of the present can sustain only a handful of structured representations at once, then the fate of any new idea depends on how many interacting elements it brings with it and how they are arranged. John Sweller framed this as a problem of load, the intrinsic complexity of the material, the extraneous burden imposed by its presentation, and the germane effort that actually builds the mental structures we call schemas, all compete for the same scarce resource. The theory's core prediction follows directly from the bottleneck we have already described. When the effective load exceeds the system's capacity to bind and manipulate representations, the hippocampus receives a fragmented, noisy pattern, and consolidation falters. When the load is well matched to capacity, the system can bind, index, and begin the long process of stabilization. At the heart of the framework is the idea of element interactivity. Material is difficult, not because it is long or technical, but because the meaning of each part depends on multiple other parts simultaneously. For a novice in algebra, a single line of symbolic manipulation has high interactivity. Each symbol's role is contingent on the rest. For an expert, the same line collapses into a single familiar move, a chunked unit with low effective interactivity. Schemas are the currency of this collapse. Once encoded and strengthened, they allow the mind to treat what was formerly many as one, reducing the apparent complexity at the gateway of working memory. From a biological perspective, this is precisely what a fast hippocampal indexing system and a slower neocortical learning system are built to achieve. Bind particulars rapidly, then generalize across repetitions until the cortex can carry the structure without continuous hippocampal support. This reframing clarifies why extraneous load matters so much. Extraneous load is not mere annoyance. It is structural noise injected at the point of binding. Split attention across distant sources, decorative detail that competes for selection, redundant explanations that force reconciliation, all of it occupies the oscillatory and executive machinery that would otherwise bind the relevant pattern. In our earlier discussion of synaptic pruning, we emphasized that efficient networks emerge as much by subtraction as by addition. Cognitive load theory offers the cognitive analog. An input that is cleaner, more coherent, and less divided allows the system to sculpt a sparser, more discriminative code. Conversely, presentations that multiply irrelevant contingencies risk driving plasticity toward diffuse traces that are harder to reinstate and easier to overwrite. Germane load, the constructive, organization-building effort, is where the theory intersects most directly with the biology of consolidation and sleep. If learning is the transformation of fast, hippocampus-dependent episodes into stable cortical structures, then the useful portion of cognitive effort is precisely the work that maximizes replay, reinstatement, and integration. Our prior essay on sleep described how slow-wave oscillations, hippocampal sharp-wave ripples, and thalamic spindles coordinate the nocturnal negotiation between new traces and old networks. From the vantage of cognitive load theory, one can think of well-directed germane effort as writing a trace that sleep can use, a pattern with enough coherence and linkage to existing knowledge that replay has a scaffolding to strengthen and pruning has a target to spare. The theory also predicts, and the literature repeatedly shows, the so-called expertise reversal pattern. Scaffolds that lower effective load for novices can hinder experts by colliding with their existing schemas. This is not a pedagogical quirk, but a consequence of representational granularity. Once a domain has been compressed into large overlearned chunks, additional step-by-step guidance re-expands what the expert automatically treats as a single move back into many interdependent elements, inflating element interactivity and increasing extraneous reconciliation work. Put differently, schemas do not just reduce load, they change what counts as load. Finally, cognitive load theory is often presented as an instructional design toolkit, but at root it is a theory about the architecture of learning. It links the phenomenology of effort to measurable constraints in prefrontal gating and thalamocortical coordination. It connects the logic of chunking to hippocampal neocortical division of labor. It explains why poorly structured input fails not after days, but in the first few seconds of binding. Read alongside our earlier essays on synaptic pruning and on sleep's role in systems consolidation, it sketches a complete arc, a narrow, attention-dependent gateway, a set of pressures that determine what passes through, and a nightly choreography that decides which patterns endure as schemas and which are pared away. I discuss more on Sweller's cognitive load theory in my previous post, The Sweller Load. Short-term memory. Short-term memory is the vestibule between the work of the moment and the architecture of the past. Unlike working memory, which is defined by active manipulation and executive control, short-term memory is chiefly a matter of maintenance, keeping a representation available for a brief interval after the stimulus has gone. The time course is measured in seconds, sometimes stretching toward a minute, and the fate of what is held here is precarious. Items that are not bound to goals, rehearsed, or linked to existing structures tend to dissolve, displaced by new input, or simply fading into the background noise of ongoing activity. At the neural level, there are at least two complementary ways the brain accomplishes this holding pattern. One is sustained activity in distributed cortical circuits. A chorus of neurons in sensory and association areas continues to fire in a pattern that recapitulates the just seen figure or just heard word. This reverberatory account has been a workhorse of cognitive neuroscience, supported by recordings that show stimulus-specific firing persisting across the delay of a memory task. The other, less obvious mechanism is what has been called activity-silent retention. Brief bursts of input leave short-lived changes in synaptic efficacy. Biophysical adjustments in receptor states, phosphorylation, and local spine dynamics that can preserve a latent trace even when overt firing subsides. In that view, a cue at the end of the delay does not read an actively humming pattern. It reawakens a configuration that was stored in the transient microphysics of the synapse. Both mechanisms likely operate, with the brain choosing between energetically expensive persistence and cheaper, hidden states depending on demand. Short-term retention is anatomically plural. Verbal material recruits parasylvian networks spanning superior temporal and inferior frontal regions, Visuospatial material leans more heavily on occipito-parietal circuits. Olfactory and somatosensory traces rely on their respective sensory cortices with association area support. The hippocampus is not required for every short delay, but relational content, bindings among items or between an item and a context, draws it in even at short timescales, revealing that short-term and hippocampus-independent are not synonymous. Basal ganglia and thalamic loops, which gate the contents of working memory, also shape what is admitted to and protected within these buffers, underscoring that selection and maintenance are inseparable parts of the same control problem. Forgetting here bears the signatures of both time and interference. A representation can decay because the biophysical substrate is transient. Synaptic facilitation and short-term potentiation simply relax back to baseline. But more often, loss reflects collision. Newer inputs recruit overlapping populations, mask the older pattern, or overwrite fragile bindings. The classic asymmetries of proactive and retroactive interference, what came before sabotaging what comes after, and vice versa, are thus not quirks of laboratory design, but consequences of shared representational space. From the perspective developed in our earlier essay on synaptic pruning, there is a further logic at work. Networks that are not given reasons to reinstantiate a trace will preferentially clear it, making room for signals with better predictive value. The vestibule is not a warehouse. It is a filtering lobby that favors what will matter. Because short-term memory is largely maintenance without transformation, it does not by itself guarantee learning. Items can be perfectly available for a few seconds and yet fail to leave a durable trace. What tips the balance toward long-term storage is not mere duration in the buffer, but whether the representation can be bound into a pattern that downstream systems can index and reinstate. That is why the perceptual and cognitive context surrounding an item, the goals active in prefrontal cortex, the schemas latent in temporal networks, the salient signals carried by neuromodulators, matters so much. As we argued in our discussion of sleep's role in consolidation, the brain gives priority to traces that are coherently structured and behaviorally tagged. These are the patterns most likely to be replayed during slow-wave ripples, strengthened by spindle-coupled oscillations, and integrated without catastrophic interference. Short-term memory provides the brief temporal bridge needed to assemble such patterns. Whether a given item crosses that bridge depends on how well it fits the traffic rules of the system. Long-term memory. Long-term memory is not a warehouse where experiences are stored intact. It is a set of learning systems that transform the fleeting patterns of the present into durable, reorganizable structures. The hippocampus sits at the center of the first phase of this process. When an experience is encoded, the hippocampus binds together the cortical patterns that co-occur: sounds, sights, spatial layout, goals, affect, and creates an index that can later reinstate the distributed ensemble. Cortex, by contrast, learns slowly. Across repetitions and variations, neocortical networks extract regularities, compressing many episodes into more abstract structures that need not reference any single moment. The result is a division of labor familiar from complementary learning systems theory: rapid, interference-resistant binding in the hippocampus, paired with gradual, generalizing learning in cortex. Beneath this systems-level story lies the cellular machinery that makes stability possible. In the minutes to hours after encoding, synapses that were coactive strengthen through long-term potentiation. Receptor dynamics change, dendritic spines remodel, and local protein synthesis locks in the bias to fire together again. Synaptic tagging and capture adds a crucial nuance. Brief tags set during experience can later capture plasticity-related proteins synthesized in response to salient events, selectively stabilizing some traces over others. Neuromodulatory signals, dopamine for novelty and reward, noradrenaline for arousal, acetylcholine for state, act as biological importance markers, determining which patterns deserve the metabolic cost of consolidation. As argued in our earlier essay on synaptic pruning, maturation is as much subtraction as addition. Connections that are weak, noisy, or redundant are preferentially downweighted, sharpening the code as useful pathways are reinforced. Over days to months, the balance of dependence shifts in systems consolidation. Hippocampal indices repeatedly drive cortical reinstatement. With each successful replay, the cortical ensemble becomes more self-supporting. The standard consolidation view holds that, given time, many memories can be retrieved without hippocampal help. Multiple trace and trace transformation accounts, however, emphasize that richly detailed, time-stamped recollection continues to rely on the hippocampus, while more schematic or gist-like forms migrate to cortex. Both perspectives agree on the core transformation. The memory that endures is rarely the exact pattern that began. It is a negotiated summary that preserves what proves predictive and lets go of what does not. Sleep orchestrates much of this negotiation. As we explored in The Purpose of Sleep, slow wave oscillations in cortex, spindles from thalamus, and hippocampal sharp wave ripples lock into a precise temporal dialogue, compressing daytime patterns and driving them back through the very circuits that encoded them. REM brings a different chemistry and a freer associative mode, often implicated in integrating affect and widening the web of relations. From the standpoint of load and structure, this is where Sweller's theory meets biology. Traces that were coherently organized at encoding, those that working memory bound cleanly and that fit, at least partly, within existing schemas are the ones most easily replayed and integrated. Noisy or poorly organized inputs, by contrast, are less likely to find stable cortical homes and more likely to be thinned by pruning. The hippocampus is not a monolith in this work. The dentate gyrus enforces pattern separation, mapping similar inputs to more distinct codes so that yesterday's meeting does not overwrite today's. CA3, with its dense recurrent collaterals, supports pattern completion, allowing a partial cue to reinstate a full trace. CA1 acts as a comparator, aligning hippocampal predictions with cortical input and signaling mismatches that often recruit neuromodulators to tag the episode as significant. In parallel, medial prefrontal regions begin to carry more of the load for schema-consistent elements as consolidation proceeds, a shift that explains why knowledge that fits what we already know often stabilizes faster than knowledge that requires a novel scaffold. Remembering does not simply read out what was written, it opens the file for editing. Retrieval reactivates the hippocampal cortical ensemble, returning it to a label state in which details can be strengthened, revised, or lost before the trace is saved again. Reconsolidation protects a plastic system from catastrophic rigidity, but it also explains why confidence and accuracy can drift apart. Over time, particulars may fade while their regularities are retained. Narratives compress, sources are forgotten, and what remains is a structure that serves present inference more than past fidelity. Forgetting in this light is not a single mechanism but a family of outcomes. Some traces decay because their synaptic substrates relax back to baseline. More often, they are victims of interference. New experiences recruit overlapping neural populations and distort reinstatement. At the systems level, pruning and competition implement a kind of Bayesian housekeeping. Codes that fail to predict are weakened, freeing capacity for those that do. Long-term memory is therefore not a museum. It is an evolving library in which indexing, rehearsal, sleep-driven replay, and strategic forgetting continually reshape the shelves. Guided by the constraints of the bottleneck we began with and the priorities inscribed by attention, neuromodulators, and prior knowledge. Episodic and semantic memory. Within long-term memory, Endel Tolving's distinction between episodic and semantic systems is less a tidy taxonomy than a map of two different ways the past can live in the present. Episodic memory concerns particular events you can mentally re-enter. A conversation on a winter street, the smell of citrus in a childhood kitchen, the sequence of remarks in a dissertation defense. Its phenomenology is autonoetic. You seem to stand inside the remembered scene, and its circuitry reflects that requirement for reconstruction. The hippocampus binds together the disparate cortical patterns that made up the original moment, while a posterior medial network helps assemble spatial layout, temporal order, and situational context into a coherent scene that can be revisited. Semantic memory, by contrast, is the web of concepts, words, categories, and propositions that are no longer tethered to any specific time or place. Knowing that citrus is a fruit, that a defense follows a talk and questioning, or that Paris is the capital of France are examples of noetic knowledge, awareness without reliving, supported by widely distributed neocortical representations with an integrative hub, role often attributed to the anterior temporal lobes. The systems are dissociable but interdependent. Repeatedly recalling or encountering an idea across different episodes gradually distills particulars into generalities. Lectures, diagrams, and conversations about photosynthesis yield a concept you can deploy without re-entering any single lecture hall. This cementization is not a mere fading. It is an organized transformation. During systems consolidation, much of it negotiated during sleep, with hippocampal sharp wave ripples coordinating cortical reinstatement as described in our earlier post on sleep's choreography, details that matter less to future prediction are downweighted while regularities are strengthened. From the perspective of our essay on synaptic pruning, this is the long arc of subtractive refinement. Noisy, idiosyncratic features are pared away so that a cleaner, more discriminative code can carry the gist. What remains is not a degraded copy of an episode, but a concept with broader scope and greater stability. The traffic also runs the other way. Established semantic structures act as schemas that shape episodic encoding from the first moments of perception. Two listeners at the same lecture do not encode the same episode because their conceptual scaffolds carve the stream of information into different meaningful units. This is where Sweller's cognitive load theory meets memory biology. For the novice, high element interactivity in a new domain saturates the working memory bottleneck. Without a guiding schema, the hippocampus is asked to bind a cluttered pattern, and later replay has little clean structure to work with. For the expert, prior semantics compress many interacting elements into a single chunk. Effective load falls, binding improves, and the resulting episodic trace is both richer and easier to integrate. Expertise reversal effects in instruction are thus mirrored in memory's mechanics. As schemas grow, they do not merely store knowledge, they alter what counts as complexity at the gate. Clinically and developmentally, the distinction holds in informative ways. Damage to the hippocampal formation through hypoxia, encephalitis, or early surgical lesions produces a stark anterograde amnesia for new episodes, while often sparing much previously acquired semantic knowledge. Degeneration centered on the anterior temporal lobes, as in semantic variant primary progressive aphasia, yields the opposite signature, erosion of word meaning and concept structure, even as fragments of remote autobiographical scenes can persist. Across the lifespan, children's semantic scaffolds tend to accumulate in breadth and interconnectedness, while episodic specificity and strategic retrieval improve with maturation of prefrontal hippocampal control loops. In healthy aging, it is common to observe a relative resilience of semantic knowledge alongside declines in episodic detail. These patterns are not exceptions to a rule, but consequences of how two systems divide labor and share work. Remembering, finally, is not passive playback, but active reassembly. When a cue triggers pattern completion in the hippocampus, the cortical ensemble lights again, and the trace becomes labile. Reconsolidation permits updating, an advantage in a changing world, but it also opens the door to drift. Confidence can rise as accuracy shifts, sources are lost while propositions survive, and the narrative compresses in ways that serve present inference more than archival fidelity. Over time, the library reorganizes. Episodic shelves thin, semantic indices grow denser, and the paths between them are rerouted by nightly replay, daytime usage, and the ongoing pruning that keeps the system sparse enough to remain plastic. To speak of episodic versus semantic is, in this light, to name endpoints of a cycle. Particulars are extracted into concepts. Concepts guide which particulars will ever become episodes, and both together allow a mind to be at once situated and general, to re-enter a moment and to understand what it means.